Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, January 15th, 2019, and you're listening to Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm your co-host, Alice Daniel, and I'm here with Laura Sitsui. So what's on slate today, Laura?
Sure, Alice. So on today's show, we'll continue to look at some of the local impacts of the partial government shutdown. And we also go to a local park that's a National Historic Landmark.
And the reason for that has to do, oddly enough, with garbage collection.
And we've got lots to look forward to in the arts in the coming months. We check in with arts critic and blogger Donald Monroe.
But first, we're going to head to Bakersfield, to the Mesa Verde Detention Facility. Under federal law, Immigration and Customs Enforcement must have a contract with a local public agency. In this case, it was the small town of McFarland, just outside of Bakersfield. Well, that contract is about to end. So what happens to the facility now? FM 89's Monica Velez has this story.
As cars whiz by on Golden State Avenue near downtown Bakersfield, people shuffle in and out of a tan-colored building. Three tall flagpoles loom above the perfectly cut grass. There's a U.S. flag, the state flag, and one with the blue and green Geo Group logo. That's the private group that contracts with ICE to operate this building, the Mesa Verde Detention Facility.
Which is fenced, including barbed wire fences, around maybe a 10 or 12 foot wall. And in there are 400 detainees.
That's Eddie Lane. He's a volunteer at CWASI, which stands for Kern Welcoming and Extending Solidarity to Immigrants. Lane comes here often to talk with detainees.
What's happening here with the people who are here? That's my primary concern.
He's gotten to know several people here, including a man he visited over a 14-month period who then got deported.
We have 400 stories here, and these men and women have thousands of loved ones who are affected by what's happening here every day. And these are stories that need to be told.
And what's going to happen to the facility is unclear. In an email, the McFarland city manager, John Wooner, confirmed the city council voted in closed session to withdraw from its agreement with the Geo Group. But he wouldn't say why. He says the city sent a notice to the Geo Group in December, and it will take 90 days to go into effect. To continue operating, ICE would need to find another local agency. But a state law that went into effect last year makes this more complicated.
They're going to have to abide by SB 29, which is the Dignity Not Detention Act. The idea behind SB 29 is really to end all of these private detention centers.
That's Ivy Cargyle. She's an assistant political science professor at California State University, Bakersfield.
As we know, California has been on the forefront of stopping the Trump administration and doing whatever it is that they want to do, particularly when it comes to the issue of immigration. This bill was a response to Donald Trump.
SB 29 makes it so any for-profit detention facility like Mesa Verde cannot go into new contracts with cities, counties, or local law enforcement. The facilities that had contracts with local agencies before January 1st, 2018 are still able to operate, but they can't amend or extend the contracts they had. So the question is, what happens to Mesa Verde after 90 days?
It's easy to say that, well, the Geo Group is done, ICE is done, they're not going to operate here anymore. However, I don't think that they're going to give up that easily, given that they've been buying land right around Mesa Verde.
That land includes El Morocco Motel and the Bakersfield Dome. It's been demolished in spite of protests to preserve the concert venue. According to the Bakersfield, California newspaper, the Geo Group says it has no plans to expand, but wants to create a buffer around the facility for safety concerns. The Geo Group did not respond to Valley Public Radio's request for comment. Meanwhile, ICE says it is unable to respond to the media during the government shutdown. Nathan Allen is the warden at Mesa Verde. He won't answer specific questions about what happens when the 90 days are up. But he did say there is, quote, opportunity, unquote, to have a contract that doesn't go through a public agency. And Cargyle isn't surprised by this comment.
My assumption is that somewhere in there, there's a loophole.
Cargill can only guess what that might be. No one has tried to fight the legislation yet.
They're going to have to scrutinize the law in order to be able, or the verbiage of the actual bill, in order to be able to find those loopholes.
Cargill says Mesa Verde's existence could be up to the Kern County Board of Supervisors. She says it has authority to uphold SB 29. The director of communications for Kern County, Megan Person, says the board hasn't discussed this. She also says ICE has not contacted the county or the sheriff's department regarding Mesa Verde. But back at Mesa Verde, David Stabenfeld says many people don't even know Mesa Verde exists. He's a pastor, and he raised his concerns about the facility at a Bakersfield City Council meeting.
It was amazing, the response afterwards. People came up to me and said, I didn't realize I was here. We didn't know it was here. And one of the reasons why we're willing to speak up is we want light to be shown so that people can make a decision about how we feel about having a detention center here.
He says people in the community need to be aware of what goes on inside Mesa Verde.
We then need to really ask the question, how are we going to be treating those who are in detention?
For Stabenfeld, that's as important a question as whether Mesa Verde will remain open. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
Trees in Tahoe are beautiful at this time of year, often covered in big clumps of snow, but that beauty can belie the danger of California's dense forests and the potential for wildfire. Californians have been talking a lot about how to make them safer, but what about the costs? Well, let's head to the Tahoe National Forest with Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero to find out.
Deep in the woods, giant machines called masticators and skids are plucking trees from the earth as if they were toothpicks.
This equipment is picking the branches off of it, placing it in a pile ready to go to the mill.
That's Joe Flannery with the Tahoe National Forest.
Let's move out of the way here as this piece of equipment is about to drive right where we're standing.
This is forest thinning. It's a fast way to clear flammable material to prevent large-scale wildfires. It's important because many of California's forests are overgrown. This plus climate change make forests prone to devastating wildfires. Flannery and I are hiking through an area like this not too far from Truckee.
I'm crunching along. So one of the symptoms of an unhealthy forest is this excess understorage. Kind of hard to walk through.
Making our forests safer is expensive. Look at it this way. The Tahoe National Forest is 1.3 million acres. $7 million was recently allocated to help manage the effects of climate change. But that money will go to treat just 9,800 acres. That barely scratches the surface. That's roughly $1,400 per acre, says Kim Carr with the National Forest Foundation running the project.
You can get very discouraged because the challenge is big. We have to keep the urgency around this because, I mean, no one wants to see another paradise.
She says working with foundations saves money, time, and gets rid of government bureaucracy instead of giving the money straight to the Forest Service. But can we manage our forests on the cheap? UC Berkeley forestry specialist Bill Stewart says yes.
There are certain areas that it is going to cost you $700 an acre on some acres, but other acres you can treat for $50 or $100 an acre.
Stewart thinks there's an even more economical way, but it's controversial, using more logging as a tool to fund forest health projects.
If we try to do like gardening in someone's suburban areas, it's going to cost billions upon billions upon billions. We found we could reduce fire risk by half on about 80% of the acres, but actually break even.
If Stewart were a doctor, the forest would be a sick patient, and he'd prescribe a mix of logging, thinning, controlled burns, and reforestation.
Do we keep having two totally different ways of doing forest management, or do we try to look at what are the best techniques that the private sectors use and kind of meld them to the goals we have for federal land?
That's a question foresters like Mike Cartmill with the Tahoe National Forest are pondering, because stopping wildfires from growing so big will take removing a lot of trees.
The simple thing that I notice is there's just too many straws in the cup. We have to thin it out, and we have to do it in a responsible way.
We met on a prescribed burn near Truckee. That's where the forest is thinned and then intentionally lit on fire. Crews are cutting down hazard trees in the charred area. The goal is to make forests like the one Cartmill knew as a kid.
I always remember the big, wide trees and that feeling you get of these decadent, large trees that have been in the landscape for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's what we want to get to.
For forests to get a clean bill of health, Cartmill admits there's a lot more work to do, and it's proving to be expensive, time-consuming, and occasionally controversial. In the Tahoe National Forest, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Cleaning up forests takes a lot of federal funding, something that's still in limbo due to the partial government shutdown. And as of this week, the shutdown also meant many federal employees went without a paycheck.
Some of the workers affected are right here in the San Joaquin Valley. I interviewed a reporter with Vice News Tonight on HBO who came out to Fresno to hold a roundtable discussion with employees from the nearby federal prisons. That reporter is Alexandra Jaffe, and here's what she heard from those prison workers.
They're experiencing particular hurt during this shutdown because they're considered essential staffers, so they're required to go to work, but they're not getting a paycheck. So we were there speaking with them about how that's affecting their lives.
All right, and so it's really the financial thing. And are many of them living paycheck to paycheck? Like, is this really hitting them hard in part because of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a misconception about federal workers, particularly because you look at Washington, D.C., and you see a lot of very well-paid people here in D.C. There's a misconception that these guys are paid well, they've got great benefits, you know, they're living very comfortable lives, but that's not true for a lot of the nation's federal workers, and particularly these guys were telling us, you know, we do live paycheck to paycheck. Their first paycheck that they're expecting to miss is supposed to come through this weekend, the weekend of the 11th. And so a lot of them, you know, were sort of wondering what to do. They've got bills coming in. They've got, you know, insurance payments, mortgages. They have to pay for gas money. And they're not quite sure how to make ends meet.
And I recall in your reporting, you spoke to one of them, or you went on maybe an Uber ride with one of them. Are they all sort of trying to do side hustles and cobble together backup plans? How are they, if at all, like planning to get by if their paycheck doesn't come through this weekend?
Yeah, exactly. It's gotten to that point for some of them that they've had to take on additional jobs. A lot of them, you know, don't have a lot of savings. Like I said, are working paycheck to paycheck. We spoke to two individuals that have to pay child support that they currently can't make. And so they're taking on these side hustles. One of them was driving Uber, and, you know, he said he makes maybe $100-$150 a week, but it helps him put food on the table right now while he's uncertain about when his next paycheck will come through. I actually also spoke with an individual that just voluntarily furloughed himself. So he sent a letter to his management and said, I can't come to work anymore. I'm not resigning, but I'm taking this time to find myself a full-time side job so that I can pay my bills. So the situation's getting pretty dire for some of these guys. And, you know, not all of them can do a side job as well as their job at the prison. So some of them are looking to take time off.
Had any of them experienced a shutdown before?
Yes. You know, as you know, there have been 3 shutdowns this year. There have been many more before that. And so all of the four, you know, Bureau of Prison staffers we spoke to had experienced previous shutdowns, but they all said this one feels different because in the past it seemed like everyone in Washington wanted to come to a conclusion. And now that's not the impression that they're getting, especially with the president saying, you know, this could go on for months or years. These guys are taking that seriously and they're concerned about the fact that there doesn't seem to be an end in sight.
Some of them in your reporting, they told you, some of the men at the roundtable said that they had been Trump supporters, had voted for him, but, you know, expressed, of course, their frustration, as you mentioned, that they seem to be like taking the hit for this shutdown. It's affecting their livelihoods. And so can you talk a little bit about the people who in particular said they had supported Trump? What are they feeling right now?
They feel betrayed. We spoke to two individuals that were originally Trump supporters, and one who said specifically, you know, I voted for Donald Trump because he said he would take care of law enforcement and take care of veterans. And he was, you know, a veteran and obviously a corrections officer. And he said, he's let me down. He's sort of betrayed that promise, and I haven't seen it. And so this shutdown specifically has left a lot of these guys feeling like, you know, Donald Trump doesn't realize how much he's affecting them, and that his claim to take care of them was a campaign promise that he's broken. So it was interesting. They said that not only their support has disappeared for the president, but they've heard from a lot of other guys that this was sort of his base of support, and now he's losing it over this shutdown fight, that they can't figure out why, you know, they can't come to a conclusion. So it'll be interesting to see if that continues.
And it seems like a lot of the conversation lately, at least from, you know, national media, and has been that Trump is calling for a wall. He's really wanting funding. And we heard that, you know, when he had a sit down with Democrats, the first question was, will I get money for a wall? And when they said no, he walked out. What did the federal employees you spoke to, how do they feel about a wall? Is that something that they're thinking about as well?
Well, absolutely. They've been paying attention to the debate here, but all of them said that they were no longer in favor of a wall. I mean, there were a couple of guys that said, look, we work for a prison. We know that walls only work as well as they're staffed. So a wall isn't, you know, the final solution. But these two individuals I spoke to that were Trump supporters and were in favor of a wall said, at this point, a wall isn't worth it. A wall isn't worth my paycheck. If I can't feed my family, then it doesn't matter if we have a wall at the southern border. So it seems like even that is losing some support, and especially when it's hurting people's livelihoods and their ability to, you know, support their families, it no longer seems like a fight worth having.
What, if anything, surprised you the most in your conversation with these federal employees?
One of the things that was most concerning that came out of it was their concerns about their colleagues' safety, both with respect to their mental health and just generally being on the job and having, you know, all of this stress of already working at a prison, but then having additional stress on your shoulders of trying to figure out how am I going to feed my family at the end of the day. All of them said that that's the kind of situation that leaves the door open for an inmate to take advantage of, you know, a distracted guard and could make prisons unsafe in the long run. So they're concerned about, you know, some of these prisons becoming more unsafe as these guards become more distracted because they're dealing with these personal issues because they're not getting paid. And they were also concerned about the high rate of suicides at corrections facilities. The rate is already particularly high. There's a prison in Victorville, California that has a particularly high rate for the nation. And the guard from Victorville said, you know what, I'm worried that I'm going to get a call from one of these guys, or I'm going to hear that one of these guys just went over the edge because he couldn't take it anymore, because he can't, this was the thing that pushed him over the edge. He can't make ends meet anymore. So it seems like the situation really is getting particularly dire, because it was already tough to be a prison worker to begin with. And now that they're not getting paid, it's getting to a breaking point.
Wow. And I'm sure as it continues, we'll keep looking out for more reporting about this. We've been speaking to Alexandra Jaffe, reporter and correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. One of her latest stories is about this government shutdown and how it's affecting federal employees right here in the San Joaquin Valley. Alexandra, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In addition to prison workers, Fresno is also home to a lot of Internal Revenue Service employees affected by the shutdown. Laura, you spoke to some of those employees last week, right?
Yeah, I did. So they were holding a rally outside one of the Fresno IRS buildings about the shutdown. So like these prison workers, some of them have been deemed essential. One of those employees that I spoke to, she said she's basically working for free. Her name is Laura Sands. Here's what she told me.
It's hard. It's hard when you're the only one making money and your bills are paid, your mortgage is paid, and they don't even want to work with you.
You can hear that she's speaking over some yelling, and before that, the crowd was chanting. This rally was one of many happening around the nation, including in places like Washington, D.C. It was organized by NTEU, the National Treasury Employees Union. There's a local chapter in Fresno, and they're the ones who organized this.
So what were they chanting?
They were saying things like, the government shutdown's got to go, and we want to work, and we want to be paid, things like that.
And who else did you speak with? I'm guessing that not all of them were essential employees.
No. So Laura Sands was there with a friend and who hasn't worked. Her story seemed to be a little more common among the people I interviewed. That woman's name is Deborah Stone. Like I said, she hasn't worked since the week before Christmas. It's been over 3 weeks since she's been on the job. And so here's what Deborah Stone told me.
Well, I have savings, but it's dwindling down. It only stays so long. And go apply for unemployment, they want you to look for a job. Being a federal employee, you have a job. I'm a perm. You can't go look for a job because IRS has to approve it, you know?
A few people told me they are applying for other jobs. That's what you have to do if you want to collect unemployment. But like Deborah said, she doesn't want to if she can help it.
I want to retire, but I'm too young. So I'm going to retire in 21. If this keeps up, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know? There's jobs I can do, but I don't want to start all over. I'm too old to start from fresh again. Give them to the young kids and stuff. And
so Deborah Stone said her savings are dwindling. Did you talk to other people who are dipping into their emergency funds?
Yeah, a lot of people I spoke to said they just don't have a lot of options. Many of them didn't have savings. They live paycheck to paycheck, and they also have car payments, house payments. So while not being able to work is one thing, not getting a regular paycheck and just a promise of receiving back pay is really not the reassurance they want.
And did any of these workers have any thoughts about the reasons for the shutdown or who they say is responsible?
Definitely. A lot of them referenced President Trump, and a lot of them told me they just don't think a wall is worth this. They're optimistic, but to reiterate, this has been really hard for them. They feel like they're casualties in a fight that's just not even about their job at all.
Pawns in the political fight in D.C. Okay, thanks, Laura. National historic landmarks are typically associated with our country's history, like Alcatraz or Manzanar, where Japanese Americans were imprisoned during World War II. But in southwest Fresno, one landmark owes its historic status to trash. Yes, it's a landfill, at least a former one. FM89's Carrie Klein spoke to an environmental historian about the gritty past of what is now a city park.
I'm standing in Regional Sports Complex. It's green and quiet and full of birds. A couple dozen people are here, climbing in the jungle gym and playing around in the half pipe of the skate park a few hundred feet away. But 80 years ago, this would have all been trash. It was the Fresno Sanitary Landfill. The old mound, now covered with grass, still looms behind baseball diamonds and picnic tables. I caught up with a few of the parents standing around the jungle gym. Did you know that this park used to be a landfill?
No, I have no idea, no.
No, actually, I didn't. It's pretty cool. Kind of just gives it a little bit of history and makes it intriguing.
The landfill closed in the 1980s. Martin Melosi, an environmental historian who recently retired from the University of Houston in Texas, tells us how it went from a trash heap to a green space.
It was the location for the first modern sanitary landfill in 1936. And what made that unique was that the landfill, unlike a dump where you just take things and just throw them in a big heap, you are building these trenches, digging them out with trucks, and then putting the garbage in the trenches, then covering them every day with a layer of dirt. Sometimes they use a disinfectant to take the smell out. And then the next day you repeat the same thing until you fill the trench, and then you move on to the next. It seems like an obvious idea, but nobody really had done it in a systematic way. And the major reason was to keep out rats and mice and other vermin, and also to make it indeed sanitary. So a public works director in Fresno, his name was Gene Vincennes, was the one that came up with this idea, and it spread all over the country and indeed all over the world. It was revolutionary because until that time, a lot of cities were just simply dumping waste in the ocean or in lakes, or they were burning it indiscriminately on land. There was some incineration being done, but the landfill was really a good option in the United States where you had cheap, available land and relatively sparse populations.
So what kinds of stuff were disposed of here in the Fresno Sanitary Landfill?
Well, the intention was to use municipal solid waste. That is, whatever is generated from residential and commercial establishments in the city of Fresno and environs. In time, however, either through illegal dumping, which occurred, or because somebody looked the other way or whatever, you begin to see toxic materials entering the landfill. And in some cases, this had to do with the changing nature of available material. So as you get more synthetic material, plastics, and so forth, the composition of the landfill began to change. And all of those things, of course, elevated the toxicity of the landfill.
And so it's no surprise then that in the late 80s, the Fresno Sanitary Landfill became a Superfund site.
Yeah, it was partly a question of what was being dumped there. The other reason was the way the landfill was constructed. Modern landfills, ones we still have, usually and now by law have to have a liner of some kind underneath. So this might be, you know, a plastic type in combination with some clay. But none of that was required at the time. And so what you had happen was with a continual rain, you'd have a leaching out of material into the groundwater. And the other thing that occurred was the compaction in the landfill oftentimes created methane gas, which could explode or could escape. And so both of these elements, these environmental risk factors, were not taken into account in the 30s, and the modern landfills do. So it kind of gives the impression that the sanitary landfill was not terribly sanitary, but we use that term in comparison with what came before.
Right. And we should specify that also in the 1980s is when the landfill was shut down also and not used anymore for that purpose. But of course, the reason that we're talking about this is that in 2001, this landfill was named a National Historic Landmark. It's a designation bestowed by the National Park Service for sites with national significance, like many homes and historical figures or buildings that were central to things like the civil rights movement. And you, of course, were instrumental in applying for this title for the Fresno Sanitary Landfill. Why did you think it deserved this historic status?
Well, I think it met almost all the criteria, and the most important was that it was nationally significant in terms of sanitation, public health, and city service development. It had these kinds of impacts on our society. And that is really at the core of what these historical sites are all about. It isn't a question of celebrating a particular type of site. For example, we have Japanese concentration camps and mines and all other kinds of things that represent kind of the distaff part of our life in the United States, but they are historically significant for a variety of reasons. And so oftentimes the public understanding of why such a site might be elevated to such a position, it was not well understood. But it's a very, very long and arduous process, and the sanitary landfill in Fresno met all those criteria after a very, very elaborate research and writing period.
Right. It was very long. You mentioned to me earlier that it took you a number of years. But then, of course, in 2001, once it gained this historic status, that wasn't the end of the story. The designation then launched the landfill and you into the national spotlight. Tell me about the controversy that ensued.
Yeah, on the morning when the announcement was made about the various sites that had been elevated to this position, I got a phone call from Washington from Roby Lang, who was the person I was working with within the National Park Service, and said that the Secretary of Interior was up in arms about this being included on the list. Nobody at the National Park Service was allowed to speak publicly, and so that left me if I wanted to talk or not. And I went on NPR that morning, and then I did, 20 or so more interviews that day and the next day. Answering a lot of questions, mostly about why would a Superfund site be placed on this list. And the implication that came out of Department of Interior was that somehow that was hidden from the officials there. But indeed, I'd written a really long section on that part of its history. So that was disclosed. Everything was disclosed. And there was a lot of questions about whether this was a kind of a political move on the part of the Bush administration to, again, reassert their what appeared to be kind of an anti-environmental credentials. And I had to make clear that this project had begun under the Clinton administration. It was not politicized. The Bush administration had nothing to do with it. It was something that happened internally within the National Park Service. and had to answer all those questions. And I guess the biggest issue was the difficulty in people grasping the fact that a dump or a sanitary landfill, and those words were used kind of interchangeably, could indeed be historically significant. And to me, that was the most frustrating part, that, you know, maybe we had not done a good enough job over the years in trying to demonstrate why these sites are so important to our well-being. But that all came out, and so for a few days, it was all kinds of activity.
Yeah, indeed. People were talking about this everywhere, from public officials to environmental groups. And the Secretary of the Interior at that time had even threatened to revoke the National Historic Landmark status, correct, of the landfill. What happened then? That never actually happened, right?
Yeah, well, she thought she could do it. She didn't understand the rules, and that kind of decommissioning it was almost as difficult as commissioning it to begin with. So, you know, it never happened, and it remained historic landmark. I felt particularly bad for the officials in Fresno, who had been incredibly cooperative with me and with Roby, had done a lot of remediation on the site already. They had already had recreation facilities. I think there was a baseball diamond there or some other facilities already in place. They were hoping to be able to use this as a springboard to kind of enhancing their community, and it was an embarrassment to them, and they really did nothing to deserve that.
And it was partly because of 9/11 also that this controversy died down in the federal government, right?
Yeah, I mean, the controversy itself, the designation went on, but this was in the summer of 2001, and then certainly with 9/11, all bets were off. Everything was off the board in terms of what was making the news, what was important to the nation. So, yeah, it just kind of stopped then. It kind of showed up periodically now and then, but the intensity of that issue just kind of faded with 9/11.
Very interesting. Well, Martin Melosi, retired professor of history from the University of Houston, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Now let's turn to the arts. When we last spoke with arts critic Donald Monroe, he was reinventing his blog and trying a new approach, similar to public radio, by rallying sustaining members. Today, he's here to tell us about some upcoming theater and dance events, now that winter is upon us and we need a good reason to get out of the house. So how is your blog going? How is the sustaining membership going?
It's going really well. I had a very successful membership drive that I did for the last 2 months of 2018, and I added about 65 new members, so I'm up past my goal, which was 150.
So, as an arts critic, tell us what's going on right now. What do we have to look forward to the next couple of weeks?
Well, the first big event is actually tonight. It is The King and I, which is the national tour that is going to make a stop at the Sorian Theater, and it's going to play for two performances. And I'm really looking forward to this production, not because I've never seen The King and I have seen that show many times, but because this is a tour of the 2015 Broadway revival, which sort of changed some things, made it fresh, took out some of the topics or issues that might make it really dated. I mean, this was a musical that came out in the early 1950s, so
it is dated now, unless you refresh it.
Right, so its approach to race and some things were
correct. So what are some of the things they have done to change that?
Well, essentially, of course, one of the biggest things is they do not use white actors in Asian roles, which today seems just kind of a
obvious
given.
Mm-hmm.
But back in, again, the early 1950s, that was not the case. And they beefed up the women's roles in the show just a little bit. So it's Lady Tiang and Anna. And so it has kind of a fresher gender outlook, I guess you could say.
The women are stronger.
The women are stronger. Of course, the story is still going to be the same, but they do try to kind of...
But the music, what do you think of the music?
Oh, the music is gorgeous. You know, Rodgers and Hammerstein's music, it's all there.
What are some of your favorite songs from The King and I? Tell me one.
Well.
And sing it.
I am not going to sing because I haven't been hydrated this morning. Of course, Shall We Dance is one that just goes
which
through
is one that everyone
my
knows.
Head.
Right.
Yeah.
And then another musical coming up, we should mention, is Rent, which was, it's based on Puccini's opera La Boheme.
Right.
So La Boheme was about young Bohemians living in the Latin Quarter of Paris in the 1840s, but right. Rent is about young Bohemians living in Alphabet City in New York City.
Alphabet City, and it, during, of course, was an amazingly daring production. It was one of the first shows to talk about the AIDS crisis, and, you know, you listen to the lyrics, and it's all about AZT, and but it's also a really sweet love story, really powerful music.
Well, it was groundbreaking, right?
Completely groundbreaking.
Because of the subject matter?
Because of the subject matter. I would say because of the structure. It's basically an opera in terms of it's sung all the way through, but with a really strong rock score. And there have been rock operas before, but this one just seemed to it seemed to combine Broadway musical and rock music in a way that hadn't been done before. And my suggestion for folks is, if you've never seen Rent, it actually is good to either read the synopsis or listen to the music a little before you go, because number one, some of the lyrics are just hard to understand. It's rock and roll. And the second is that a lot of the parts are intertwined, like in an opera. So it's hard to follow necessarily what the individual characters are singing, unless you've kind of listened to the music. And
plus, it just makes it more fun if you know the music beforehand.
It does.
So Rent is playing in February, right? So
yeah.
The King and I is tonight, actually.
The King and I opens tonight, and Rent plays February 6th and 7th. And this is the anniversary tour of Rent. So it has played in Fresno before, but it hasn't played in a long time.
Okay. So let's look at some other theater. You said Selma Arts Center is coming up with something.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to Selma Arts Center and The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
Which was also a Broadway production.
Based on a book, and was a very well-reviewed show on the Tony Award. It's about this boy who is autistic and sort of this strange adventure that he embarks on. And
he's solving a mystery.
Solving a mystery. And what the play, at least on Broadway, did was it really kind of replicated what it would be like to live in this kind of overly stimulated environment. And so it's a very theatrical type of experience.
And then we should also mention Mamma Mia, because you said Good Company Players is bringing it back after 10 months.
Mamma Mia is back after 10 months. So Good Company is going to reopen that show on Thursday. And it is less than a year since it last played at Good Company. So that tells you something about how well it did at the box office. It's a very popular title. And Mamma Mia is kind of the it title of the year. There is going to be a production by Stageworks Fresno that's coming up in July. And you probably will see it performed by other companies as well. And a major reason for that is because the rights become available to a title for community theater, and then everybody wants to jump on it.
Of course. Plus, it's such a fun musical.
It is.
And with music from ABBA.
And people love it. They get up and dance at the end. You know, it's a very
it's one you don't have to listen to before you go
you
in.
Do
you know
not,
the music.
You don't.
Okay, so now let's talk about some artists. I know you said you interviewed Anne Scheid, who's a lovely artist from Fresno, correct? And you interviewed
yes,
her for your CMAC show.
I did.
So what is she doing now?
So people who know Anne Scheid's work will be a little surprised, because it's a little different from what she's done in the past. Anne is known for her black and white drawings, usually done on a very large scale. She was the drawing professor at Fresno City College for many years. And in this show, which is at the Fig Tree Gallery, she is kind of splashed into color, I guess you could say. She's experimenting with watercolors and with drawing. It's all on paper, so it kind of follows that part of her her
She's
style.
She's using that medium, but it's with watercolor.
But it's with watercolors. And so, yeah, it's a big departure. And she says, you know, I want to keep trying new things.
And speaking of black and white, you said at the Sorensen Gallery, there's a show called Black and White, or is
right. it? Right. So what's funny is that Anne's work would usually be very welcome at the annual black and white show at Sorensen Gallery. But this year it won't be because the Sorensen show is limited to just black and white. If there's any color, you don't get to enter.
What about dance? Do we have anything good coming up in terms of dance?
We do. It's really exciting to welcome a world-class dance company to the Valley. And so the Lively Arts Foundation is bringing back Ailey 2, which is the sort of child company of the Alvin Ailey Company in New York. But it's a very well-known and reputable dance company on its own. And they're going to be coming to the Soroyan on the February 24th.
We've talked a lot about what's going on in Fresno and Selma. Is there anything outside of this area that you would recommend?
Well, I am looking forward to a production of Grey Gardens in Visalia. That's the Visalia Players at the Ice House Theater. Grey Gardens is a wonderful musical. It was done a couple of years ago by Stageworks Fresno. One of the most unlikely candidates for a musical you can think of.
Right, it's about two sisters.
Two sisters that are related to the Kennedys, who are kind of holed up in this house.
Live in a crumbling mansion.
Yeah, and there was a very famous documentary movie that was done about them, and the musical is weird and wonderful. So
that's
an appealing title for them, and that opens on the February 1st.
February 1st. Okay. All right. So we've got a lot to look forward to during these winter months. Let's talk again when the wildflowers are in bloom and spring is upon us.
Sounds
Thanks
good.
Thanks a lot, Donald.
Thank you.
Wisconsin-bred, Georgia-based musician John McCutcheon is folk music's renaissance man, master multi-instrumentalist, powerful singer-songwriter, storyteller, activist, and author. His latest album, released on January 11th, is a tribute to his longtime friend and mentor, Pete Seeger. John McCutcheon will be performing at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fresno on Thursday, January 18th, in a concert presented by Fresno Folklore Society. FM89's David Ouse recently had a chance to catch up with John McCutcheon.
John McCutcheon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
You're touring now in support of your 40th album, a major milestone in any career.
Most are not foolish enough to get there.
Well, we're gonna spend this time finding out how you got there. How did you start playing music? Did you grow up in a musical family?
No, and even among my, you know, sizable clan of siblings, I'm the eldest of nine. I'm the only one that even plays an instrument. I guess it was a never-ending quest to figure out a way to avoid gainful employment your entire life. And I was lucky enough to stumble on it. My first exposure to music at all was my mother taking me to a community concert piano recital, because I had made noises that I wanted to take piano lessons, and she wanted me to hear someone actually play the piano well. And I remember being in that hall and feeling like this was kind of like church. I mean, everybody was dressed up and everybody was paying attention to one person up on the stage. And I came out of there feeling, I was 8 years old. I thought, wow, I feel like a different person. I want to do that again. But the next milestone was my mom again, making me sit down and watch the March on Washington on television when I was 11 years old. She thought I ought to see this. And what was really different about it for me, besides the fact there were 200,000 people and there was all this preaching like I never heard on Sunday, was this music. And it was everything from Mahalia Jackson to Bob Dylan. And I'd never heard of folk music before, didn't know it existed, but that day really changed me and my best friend growing up, who lives in Fresno, amazingly enough. And I just started talking about folk music and listening to it. We both got guitars, and he ended up being a doctor, so he got a real job. But I just kept playing that guitar, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Some of that history involves travels to Appalachia, am I right?
Yeah, I played the guitar through high school, and then when I was about 17 or 18, I picked up the banjo and convinced my advisor to let me do a 3-month independent study hitchhiking around the Appalachian South, meeting banjo players. And it's a 3-month independent study that I'm still on 47 years later.
And you picked up a few other instruments as well.
Yeah, when when you're not taking lessons formally, where it's you and a teacher in a room and you're both focusing in a very academic way and an organized way on how to play this instrument, you know, I was finding myself at people's houses and there'd be banjo players and fiddle players and mandolin players there, and you were exposed to this entire sonic smorgasbord, and it was exhilarating. And, you know, there was no in my vocabulary. So, yeah, I'll pick up the fiddle and try to torture people with that. And the fiddle and the mandolin have the same fingerings. And I just picked up things. I'm still learning to play musical instruments, but I'm smart enough not to play the ones I'm not at least passably proficient on stage.
Well, that's one of the great things about music, is lifelong learning.
Oh, yeah. And it's often fueled by my travels around the world. I will come home and my wife will say, oh, I see you've been to Australia. That must be a didgeridoo. Or you've been to Sweden. That must be a nickel harpa. And to me, in some ways, it's my souvenir, both physically and internally. I bring back the sounds, and it's a big, beautiful world out there.
Now, you're a fabulously gifted instrumentalist, and as we mentioned, you play many instruments. Let's talk a little bit about your progression into writing songs, the other side of music.
Oh, I started writing songs the minute that I started playing the guitar, you know, because my exposure was at the March on Washington, you had Joan Baez singing a Tim Hardin song. You had Peter, Paul, and Mary singing a Bob Dylan song and a Pete Seeger song. And of course, you had Bob Dylan singing Bob Dylan songs. So it seemed connected. And so I started off writing really terrible songs, which was really informed, though, by my education in traditional music. Here was music that was worn smooth and beautiful on 1,000 tongues before mine. So learning a lot about traditional music really helped me be a better songwriter. Again, lifelong learning. I still feel like I'm 66 years old now, and I feel like I'm just learning how to do my job right.
We're speaking with multi-instrumentalist, singer, songwriter, and storyteller John McCutcheon, who will be performing in Fresno on Thursday, January 17th at the Unitarian Universalist Church. His latest album is his 40th. It's entitled To Everyone in All the World, A Celebration of Pete Seeger. I'd like to hear about your association with Pete Seeger.
My mother was a social worker before she became a mother, and she was very interested in the civil rights movement. So it was something that she paid attention to. It was on the news every night. And she was also one of those mothers who answered questions, no matter how simplistic they were, from her, you know, very questioning son. And Pete had this album, a live concert recording he'd done in Carnegie Hall, and he had just come back from singing around the South as part of the Civil Rights Movement. And he had all these songs that he'd brought back up, and he put them out in an album called We Shall Overcome. And it was the very first LP I ever bought, and it was transformative because it was a live concert recording, and it was nothing like the concert I had been to with my mom at age 8. It was celebratory. It was loud. I mean, you had this audience who sang along, and not just, you know, Mitch Miller sing along. They were singing in harmony, and it was just transformative. And it was the beginning of my relationship with Pete, though it would be 5 or 6 years before I met him. He was a remarkable man. He treated me like a peer from day one, even though he was my elder in every imaginable way. We performed many times together. We worked on different projects together, and he was just a lovely, generous man. And his wife, Toshi, was a rock. I loved Pete. I adored Toshi. This would have been Pete's 100th birthday this year. I had done an album of Woody Guthrie songs in honor of his 100th birthday, and an album of Joe Hill songs commemorating the 100th anniversary of his death. And I just knew Pete felt like the third leg in that three-legged stool for me. So this was an album I've been waiting 50 years to make, and it was a total labor of love.
We'll take a moment now to listen to something. What's something you'd like our listeners to hear?
We'll go easy at first. How about the very first cut in the album, Well May the World Go, with my buddies from the great bluegrass band Hot Rise.
Singer-songwriter John McCutcheon from his latest album, To Everyone in All the World, a celebration of Pete Seeger. Here's a taste of Well May the World Go.
Sweet may the fiddle sound, banjo play the old hoedown, dancers swing round and round when I'm far away. Well may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well may the world go when I'm far away. Well may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well may the world go when I'm far away.
That was a little taste of the Pete Seeger song, Well May the World Go, performed by John McCutcheon from his latest album, To Everyone in All the World, joined there by his friends in the great bluegrass band Hot Rise. John McCutcheon is our interview guest today. How did you go about selecting collaborators for this project?
I started with what approach I wanted to take with a particular song. With Well May the World Go, I knew I wanted to do this as a bluegrass song. This is a song that I have opened concerts with for 40 years. I mean, not every concert, but often. It's just a wonderful way to introduce myself, to get the audience involved. And I knew I wanted to do this as a bluegrass song, and it was a no-brainer. I've been friends with Hot Rise for 30 or 40 years, and they're just the best. In some ways, it was the easiest cut on the album. We did one take, and I was like, oh, okay, we got that. I decided I wanted to give, if I had a hammer, a Cajun feel. So again, it was no-brainer, Beau Soleil, the greatest Cajun band in the world. With Guantanamera, my wife is Cuban. It's something we sing at every family gathering. Pete did it as with, he did all these things with guitar or banjo, and I wanted to kind of flesh them out, introduce a whole new audience to the tremendous breadth of what he wrote and chose to sing. Believe me, they were really easy calls to make.
What's another track that you think people should hear from the album?
Well, we could either go something totally off the wall, like with Talking Union. That's probably the most different thing on the album. The other could be Living in the Country, or which is an instrumental with Hammer Dulcimer, or we could do Sailing Down My Golden River, which is a really beautiful duet with Susie Boggess.
Let's take a listen to Sailing Down My Golden River.
Sun and water, old life giver, I'll have them where'er I roam.
Yet I was not far from home.
That was singer-songwriter John McCutcheon with vocalist Susie Boggess singing the Pete Seeger song Sailing Down My Golden River, a selection from John McCutcheon's latest album To Everyone in All the World, a celebration of Pete Seeger. John McCutcheon will be in performance on Thursday, January 17th at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fresno.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Alice Daniel, reporters Monica Velez and Carrie Klein. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.